Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Insurers the Best Policy podcast. My name is Sophie Roberts and today I'm joined by Pat Regan, CEO of QBE Insurance Group. In the first of this two-part interview, we discuss how the global insurer is managing the impact of COVID-19, exploring what the company has initiated in terms of a response to date, his thoughts on current loss estimates, an overview of how different jurisdictions and regulators are handling the tensions around business interruption claims, and how eventually the industry will be able to make the best out of what is seemingly now a bad situation. But first, we dive straight into what his key priorities have been in managing the impact of COVID-19 from a company, shareholder and customer point of view.
Hi there. Look, it's been a tremendously demanding period for everybody, isn't it? And a tremendously stressful period in different ways for everybody. So certainly back when the whole COVID episode first started and lockdowns started happening, the first priority really was to look after our people and make sure they were safe and then make sure we could equip them to work in whatever best way possible. A lot of people did a lot of very hard work in that period of time. People were working kind of 24 hours a day to set up people who hadn't really ever planned to work from home. And, you know, happy to report that worked remarkably well, both on day one and every day since. Probably exceeded our expectations in terms of both everybody's ability to carry on working as normal. And our customer response levels were as good as ever, if not better, actually, as we set people up from home. So that was kind of job number one, make sure people were safe. And then secondly, as they were kind of gradually on a rolling basis around the world sent home, including our facilities in the Philippines, make sure everybody can successfully work from home. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as we do that, one of the primary aims of doing that is to make sure we can still give our customers and our broker partners good service. I think kind of with maybe one or two minor exceptions, but generally speaking, that happened kind of without a glitch. So happy to report on that. And then really, we were trying to work out what we could do to help our end customers. So we did, here in Australia, we gave a 25% or a $50, which equated to 25% on average motor refund for our personal motor customers here in Australia through the months of April through June, just to reflect the fact that there was a lot less cars on the road, when we gave a package of help to SMEs as well. And then in addition, we did some grants through our QBE Foundation grants, where through our existing two charity partners, the Red Cross and Save the Children, we were able to get kind of about $2.5 million through to people who were really being, who were already in a disadvantaged situation, and COVID had really added on to some of their circumstances. So that was kind of good to do as well. So they were our major priorities. Obviously, we also did a capital raise in that period of time and put in place our capital plan. But kind of day one, it was all about looking after our people and helping them look after our customers.
So that leads on to sort of one of my questions, actually. You were one of the first carriers to undertake a capital raise, 1.3 billion Australian dollars in the wake of COVID-19. With the intent of shielding the company from sort of any pandemic-induced recession, how has this positioned QBE from both a preservation standpoint, but also, you know, a hardening market moving forward?
Yeah, look, it was back in March we were doing that thinking, and some things have changed, some things are the same, I think, since then. The bit that's the same is still a tremendous uncertainty in the world. I think for anybody running a business, whether you're running an insurance company, whether you're running any kind of business, a manufacturing company, it's very, very difficult to predict the future and to predict demand and revenue in the future, more than it's ever been in my 30 plus years of working life. There are much greater uncertainties in the world. And as time has gone on, some of those have become a tiny bit clearer, but actually often the uncertainty remains that we haven't seen huge numbers of business failures or very great increases in unemployment yet. But that's primarily because governments have stepped up and put in place stimulus packages that have largely worked. But clearly, that kind of all said, they're not going to carry on with those stimulus packages forever. So that economic uncertainty that probably starts to manifest itself in the fourth quarter of 2020 and then into the early part of 21, I think is still there. Stock markets are still digesting some of the economic data, so jobs data, retail data, GDP data, some's worse, some's better. Health data kind of evolves on a daily basis, doesn't it? Whichever place in the world you are. Here in Australia, we've opened up again a number of places, but now we're dealing with a further outbreak in Melbourne. So that sort of set us a tiny bit back on our heels. Obviously, some of the other countries in the world are still getting on COVID under control in terms of the number of new cases. So the kind of one of the predominant things that drove the capital raise was just unprecedented levels of uncertainty on every feature, underwriting risk, demand for underwriting, how many businesses will exist, investment values. And I think that's largely still there. What's happened, one of the things that's happened since then is we have seen better insurance pricing conditions. And so as well as giving us a balance sheet that's really fortified to withstand any form pretty much of downside, we've also got capital to deploy in actually what's a market that's now giving us some good organic growth opportunities. So it was designed to do both, and actually we're seeing definitely some good organic growth opportunities right now.
Okay, great. You know, and a couple of months ago, you also announced that your exposure to UK COVID-19 related business interruption losses would not exceed 75 million on the topic of business interruption, indicating that your portfolio is protected from any further claims by its reinsurance program. You know, as we come to the end of Q2 now, do these numbers still feel right to you, or do you envisage some sort of further adjustment?
First and foremost, no, the numbers are still right. The we have reinsurance protections in place that limit our exposure to $75 million. Obviously, we agreed to participate in the FCA test case. We're supportive of the desire to provide clarity to customers on an accelerated basis. So obviously that procedure's ongoing now. It's probably inappropriate for me to comment in a lot more detail on that. But notwithstanding those outcomes, our net exposures are limited to $75 million.
And, you know, I understand that, you know, sort of hesitant to sort of comment too much on the FCA High Court sort of case, but I suppose, you know, how do you feel the UK is handling this? And, you know, how does this compare to other jurisdictions that, you know, given your global footprint?
Yeah, look, I mean, the circumstances are a little bit different to different parts of the world. There's probably more variations of wordings in the UK than there are in most markets. And I think that's one of the reasons why the regulators sought, but given there's quite a breadth of wordings, I think that's one of the reasons why the FCA sought clarity on a range of different wordings to help customers, brokers, and indeed insurers to understand that what's a reasonable claim and what isn't. Mm-hmm. In other markets in the world, there are less of those breadth of wordings, and therefore you'll have seen a case in Michigan that was just brought over the last couple of days where a judge has ruled that, for example, in that particular case, didn't involve QBE, but in that particular case, that the physical damage was required and therefore there wasn't an appropriate claim on business interruption. So I think the UK circumstances are a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And as I say, therefore, we thought it was helpful to participate in that test case.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Pat. You know, what are your sort of thoughts on the current loss estimates around sort of COVID-19 that your sort of peers have been predicting? You know, there's been a consensus that some of these early estimates, you know, should have been more cautious. Is that something you feel, or do you think they're getting about right?
Yeah, I think it's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the world on almost every level. So it's difficult to be precise predicting anything. So I certainly don't mind people making an estimate of that, sort of helps the market commentary. It's just difficult to be precise on that right now, I think. So yeah, look, I wouldn't comment on anybody's individual market estimates. Maybe some of them were a little bit wider the mark early and we'll get more clarity as we go on. But this will probably take quite a bit of time before we all have a better idea of that.
Sure, yeah. And you know, close to home, you know, for you, you know, there have been reports that you sort of stopped writing trade credit insurance for two Australian retailers over concerns the business will not survive the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, what is your outlook for this line of business more globally? I mean, you know, it's certainly sort of on the press quite frequently.
It is indeed, yes. And understandably, obviously, a number of businesses are going through times where their own demand and customer base and revenues is coming under significant changes. So we remain a significant writer of trade credit insurance in a number of markets in the world. Our biggest ones would be Australia, the UK and the US. We continue to provide significant trade credit here in Australia as well. Naturally, as we've gone through 2020, we've had to do an assessment of our underwriting risk profile, kind of as you'd imagine we would do. And we've adjusted how much trade credit we've provided on a risk-adjusted basis. So obviously, the higher impacted sectors, we've reduced the amount of trade credit insurance we've provided by a little bit more. That would have included retail as part of it.
The industry at some point will have to start thinking about its recovery management following the aftermath of COVID-19. And, you know, from your perspective, what do you think the priority should be and what do you anticipate happening? Will there maybe potentially within that be future consolidation opportunities?
I think, like out of every difficult situation, you've got to try, tough though it is at times, trying to pick the best out of it. So we've all forced into a new way of working, as we're doing now, where, you know, the adoption of digital tools has had to be much greater because we haven't had any choice. And our sectors perhaps been slower than other sectors in the world of economy to adopt technology, and this is forcing us to do it. So let's pick up that, let's pick up that theme and just really push it harder, because I think we as an industry, our customers, our broker partners will all benefit from that. So we as a company would really intend to do that, and hopefully everybody will, so we can get, you know, everything, more flexibility on working from home. I think that's been a theme that people have been trying to do for a long time. I think that can help. One of the things as an industry we need to do better is diversity, and I think it could help on diversity. That's a huge thing we need to rise to. And more digital transactions. We're a kind of industry that if you dreamt up insurance today, it's kind of made for data, artificial intelligence, machine learning, digital. I mean, you couldn't almost dream of an industry that's more made for those tools and techniques. And we've got to get it there. We've got to sort of drag it into the 21st century. And we've all got a responsibility, I think, to do that. So I really want to use this opportunity for, and I say to my team, and Ben knows this, and I kind of bore everybody with this, that let's all acknowledge that we're not fit for purpose for that kind of world. So let's retrain ourselves. So we're doing a series of learning sessions on artificial intelligence, machine learning, cloud, et cetera, to our top 200 people. So we're all kind of not quite digital natives, perhaps, but close to. So we can lead from the front on becoming a fully digital insurer.
Mm-hmm. So what is the answer to pandemic cover moving forward? And how would you like to see both the industry and, you know, national governments react in a way that the future is protected?
You know, you'll talk to a lot of people like me who'll be telling all the arguments about why business interruption is generally not covered. And that's important arguments for us to make from the kind of protecting our business, and because we believe they're the right arguments. But equally, businesses don't want to go through these kind of periods and not have appropriate insurance cover. So I think it is tremendously important that we're able to construct products that cover people for the kind of eventualities that happen. I think talking to some of the other kind of senior industry figures on the broking side as well, and it has the potential of meaning that boards will properly value tail risk, pay for it. That clearly will include pandemic cover, but it might include other cover, that these aren't just theoretical things that risk departments dream up. These are things that actually can happen and could have devastating impacts on business. So I think there's a opportunity going forward for companies and boards to really value tail risk and buy appropriate protection. For insurance brokers and insurance companies, together with, no doubt it'll need some form of government backstop to design products that really can help people. And as I say, we shouldn't just do it on pandemics. It should form all part of tail risks and a greater universe for things that sometimes are a little bit slow to come to the party on developing new products for. Let's use this as an opportunity for thinking, well, okay, so we clearly need something on pandemics that almost certainly needs to be a public-private partnership. But what else is there? What else could fall into a similar category of a risk that's not fully or appropriately insured yet?
And, you know, which sort of markets in the world do you think are sort of best placed and positioned to sort of be able to deliver on these kind of new innovative products?
Well, it tends to be the deepest pools of insurance. So the US is always a good market for that. London, though. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're going to ask me about the London market, but one of the reasons the London market's been so successful is it's come up with new products. It has got the world's leading critical mass of underwriting expertise and the ability to innovate and generate new products. And that's always why Lloyd's has thrived in the future, in the past. And so I think London should be as well. They're probably the biggest, best examples.
Thank you, Pat. That brings us to the end of the first half of our Best Policy interview with Pat Regan, Chief Executive of QBE Insurance Group. The second part of the interview will be aired at the beginning of next week and explores the strategies Pat has put in place since he took the helm of the global insurer in 2017, and also how he plans to continue to drive growth at QBE against an uncertain backdrop, focusing on North America, London and Lloyd's. Thank you for your time, Pat, and thank you to our listeners as well for tuning in. Until the next time.